My mind used to perceive you as a pure light, my spiritual guide enlightened. Ah, isn't that nice? After visiting your place this afternoon, my mind got disturbed and confused. Oh my goodness. You've lost faith in me. Hooray! One less disciple means one less thing to worry about. That dead, dark, soundproof, vampire sort of like cave, or all that obscure and evil, abusive reality to my perception. Obscure and evil perception. Abusive reality to my perception. It's not. It's not dark. It's visually peaceful. It's not soundproof. It has the beautiful music of silence. It is not vampire sort of like cave. I'm not a vampire. Apparently these vampire movies are really popular and really lots of books about vampires. You've been reading too many of those and watching the movies. No, it's not vampire. It's like day with like peace and calm and still and safe. There are three bats in that cave though. Some people went in there today and they only saw one bat. There's another one right next to it. When I first got that cave, people said there's one thing missing. A bat. Every cave has to have a bat. So I got one from IKEA. It was a fluffy bat. And this year, someone gave me another bat. I was afraid my bat was lonely. So I got another stuffed bat. And then this Sri Lankan boy said, I'm going to give you a third bat. So there's a cricket bat in there as well. That's the three bats. Which means that no wonder, as they say in English, I'm a bit batty. That doesn't make any sense. My mind started running over. There's no such an archetype, or without I know comparable to such thing. Is he good or evil? Both, none of them. Beyond good and evil. Does he have supernatural powers? Please clarify. Or P.S. Shut up and meditate. It's not a satisfying answer. You must have psychic powers, because that's what I was going to say. So I couldn't help it. Ha ha. Okay. I've already mentioned, it's interesting whatever you experience. A cave is just a cave. But it's actually what you add to that. I don't know whether your archetypes or whatever it's called. For me, I love caves. I'm not an evil monk. Ask all the people who've known me for a while. But when I was in Thailand, I loved sitting meditation in cemeteries. I think, wow, that's really weird. It wasn't, because it was the only place in Thailand where people would leave me alone. Ajahn Chah told me that. He said, look, if you want a bit of peace and quiet, you go and ask the lay people, where's the cemetery? And they'll leave you alone all night, because they're so scared of ghosts. And I know that ghosts are scared of me. So, it's a win-win situation. The lay people go away, and the ghosts go away. So they have some solitude. And know what it's like. I already told you that story about those people following me. How many brothers and sisters have you got? Now, what country did you come from? And after a while, if they're asking Dharma questions, fair enough. And the other thing they used to do when they saw me, I remember I was sitting quietly in this little forest, and this woman came up, she saw me. And she put in front of me a bottle of Coca-Cola, a pencil, and a paper. And what that meant, there's many Thai people here, you know what that meant. The Coca-Cola was the payment for putting the lottery number on the piece of paper. And so I said, no. Even though I was thirsty, I said, no, we're not doing that. And so they were always on at you. Come on, give me a lottery number. Come on, I know you can do it. Come on, don't be shy. So that's why you go to the cemetery and no one would ask you anything there. They keep away. That's the only reason why. And monks, we give caves. That's why I've got the cave there. So I can hide away from everybody. There's two doors there. So people knock on the outside, I can't hear you. This afternoon I was over in the university doing a human rights talk for 2 hours. And I come back here. Sometimes it's very hard for me to get any rest. So that's why I've got my cave. That's my place of rest. That's why I can hide away from the whole world. And also it reminds me of simplicity. You know what it's like with monks these days, especially if you become a famous monk. People want to give you all sorts of things. And if you get all sorts of things, you can have luxurious this and luxurious that. And it's true that sometimes you go to these conferences, and even when I went to Phuket, for that retreat last June, they gave me this not just an ordinary room, it was a double story room. You know, I'm only simple monk, much more, there's only me in there. And some of you, and there was already a 5-star resort, so that was 5.5 or 6 that room. And so sometimes we've got to be very careful. So I love coming back here and going into my cave. And in my cave, I remind myself I'm a simple monk. So that's really important for me. So, you know, you can keep your humility. You know, I sleep, you all see it. That's not set up for you. That's exactly, you know, how I sleep. You know, just on those little mats on the floor, and about that thick. You know, I sleep from nothing there. And when I go in there, I can meditate, I can rest. I'm a monk again. Instead of some supermodel with people flashing their cameras at me. Can I have a picture with that jambo? Tick, 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 tick. You guys must be crazy. I'm not Brad Pitt. I'm not sexy. What are you taking photos of me for? So that's why I've got the cave. It's dark, it's simple and peaceful. And that's why I love that cave. So that's not evil, it's just simple. But whenever you see anything, you know, you can see anything in that. You can see it's like a dungeon. Or the...
Wow. You can't see anything.
Exactly. Just like this. It's so dark now, I can't see anything. So it just reminds me of meditating. I just close my eyes then. And that's why I love that. It's just so peaceful. And still. And anything else out in the world, the world can go along. And I'm in there, and I've left the world. No sound. Nothing can get in there. And that's why I love that place. And remember, many monks and nuns used to meditate in the caves. It's so still and peaceful. And it's also, interestingly, I think a couple of years ago, I've got a little clock in there. And it's one of these clocks, it shows the temperature as well. And just in one range retreat, I decided just to have a look to see how much the temperature changes. And over many, many days, it changes 0.5 degree between night and day. So, you know, it's only, you know, very, very, very minimal temperature change. So even in the hot weather, and it's really hot sometimes here in the summertime, those of you who live here know, in my cave it's always really cool. And when it's really cold outside, my cave is warm. So it's natural air conditioning. So it's also really, really comfortable. So if any of you come during the summertime, January, February, it's really hot outside, it's 40 degree back days. You go in that cave, I know it's just like air con room without any use of electricity. That's why it's a brilliant design. You should get one of those yourself. Anyway, next question. With reference to your morning talk, you mentioned not to be too involved. Put a space in between. But for metta meditations, emotions are very much involved to generate metta. So how do I go about putting a space in between? Okay, metta meditation, that's a good question. You're supposed to get sort of some feelings of joy and happiness coming up. But eventually, you know, you do metta, may all beings be happy and well. Can you do that? Because look, when I was in Thailand, you know, in those jungles, I tried doing metta meditation, but I couldn't help myself. When they were doing the chant, saying, may all beings be happy and well, except mosquitoes, because they really sent me crazy. May all beings be free from pain and suffering, except those damn mosquitoes. They were accepted. I will not give any metta towards those. And you know what it's like. There must be somebody. If you just got divorced last week, may all beings be happy and well, but not my ex. No way. Never. It's not fair. It doesn't deserve it. That's the trouble. So, if you give it to all beings, you can't do it. You know, lots of people get frustrated doing metta meditation because they don't do it the right way. So, first of all, you give metta to something or some beings which are easy to give metta towards. Now, like the teddy bear. Ah, isn't it a nice teddy bear? Had a cuddle yet? Have you stroked it on the head? You can do. That's like the metta bear. And so, may the teddy bear be happy or well. And then it gets the feelings of loving kindness going. And then after it's going, then you can have other nice objects, like people you really care for and like and love. Now may they be happy and well. And then maybe you can extend it to all the yogis, all the meditators in this room. Yeah, I know some of them have caused you strife by banging the doors or taking, you know, the last banana before you get it. I do that every day, you know. But whatever it is. But yeah, I mean, they're just human beings, so may all beings in this great compound be happy and well. And then you spread it wide, and may all beings in the whole world, and yeah, it includes your ex, and it includes mosquitoes, yeah, but well, never mind. Because once you get the loving kindness going, then it can actually be spread to things like enemies. And last of all, your enemy number one, you spread it to. You know who that is? You. Yourself. Weird but true. The one person we're so critical of is ourselves. Are you senior to the teddy bear? Or is the teddy bear senior to you? You've got seniority. Actually, the teddy bear's probably older than me. Should be given the talk. Okay, great. Thank you. Thank you for playing around. So anyway, that's with metta. So eventually, even you put metta between you and your enemy. And when you put metta between you and your enemy, or between you and yourself, I can be kind to myself. So even with metta meditation, you put even metta between you and the object. And that's called metta meditation. We went to Bodhinyana Monastery and meditated in the hall today, which was very nice and peaceful. I noticed there was a Buddha statue in the main hall, and each having two disciples by its side. Could you explain the two statues and two disciples? So there's two Buddha statues, a big one and a small one. So someone, they came in there and said, the Buddha's had a baby. That's what I said. No, it's just people offer these statues, and so we've put them up. We've got this one, we've got the one outside. And the two small ones, that's Sariputra Moggallana. So the two chief disciples. So sometimes you have Buddha statues, sometimes you have the disciples as well. And you know the difference between them, because the Buddha's always got something on his head, either a flame pointing out, which is, you know, the Thai or the Sri Lankan when it's a wider flame, or a bump on his head. And it wasn't that, all that really is, because the Buddha was just like a normal person. Because sometimes there's many cases that somebody, you know, they didn't recognize the Buddha. You know, he's meditating. There was this case, this monk, sort of, he was traveling to see the Buddha, and actually the Buddha was traveling towards to see him. And the Buddha sort of arrived at this, I think it was a workshop, and there was another monk staying there, and he said, do you mind if I stay here as well? Or it was the other way around, I forget who came first. But these two monks were staying there at the same time. One was a Buddha and one was another monk, and the other monk didn't know that was a Buddha there. And then the Buddha started meditating, and this other monk started meditating. And this monk, you know, saw the Buddha wasn't moving, so he didn't move. So the two of them meditated all night. And this visiting monk said, well, you're a good meditator, who's your teacher? He said, I haven't got a teacher. What's your name? I'm the Buddha. Oh my God. I've been with the Buddha all night and I haven't even paid respect to you. I didn't know. And I think the Buddha said, no, it's very good. You're a good monk because I saw you how you meditated. And that's what a good monk should do. So well done. You've already paid respect to me by your conduct. But anyway, what was really nice there is this other monk didn't know that was a Buddha. So the Buddha just looked like another human being, you know, on the outside. But these, so when we actually got that big Buddha statue in the hall in Bodhinyana over the road, we actually asked, it didn't have any of these bumps on the head or flames. We wanted it to be something like normal. And then that was when the sculptor told us, no, it has to have something on its head, because that signifies it's a Buddha and not another being, not another monk. So that is almost like the sign it's a Buddha. The Buddha never had a flame, never had a bump. But that's a way that people know that that signifies it's a Buddha statue. That's all it is. So that's the two statues and two disciples. And do you notice that in that room, the Buddha is facing west? And Buddha statues are always supposed to face east. And sometime when we first put that statue up there, the Thai people started complaining. You can't do that. The Buddha statue is facing the wrong direction. Things are going to go wrong. And then fortunately, A couple of years later, a senior Thai monk came, a great disciple of Ajahn Chah. And that was a chance. All these Thai people came and they complained to him. Said, these Western monks, you know, don't know what they're doing. And look what they've done. They put the Buddha statue facing the wrong direction. And this Thai monk told him, he said, listen, if the Buddha wasn't happy, he'd turn around by himself. And that was the end of the problem. It was actually brilliant. And I was actually so happy about that, because now I wasn't the abbot then, I was in Jakarta, and it was catching so much flack, and this senior Thai monk came and just put it down on the line. So the Buddha was unhappy, he turned around by himself. Anyway, question number three. It's got B-U-Z-Y. So I think they mean busy, but it sounds buzzy. As a buzzy and successful monk. I like buzzy better than busy, it's a very good word. As a buzzy and successful monk, you build your own monastery, you fly here and there a whole year round. Compared to your early days with Ajahn Chah, any comments? Eh? To compare your early days with Ajahn Chah, any comments? But if true, if you build temple and monastery, when you die, you will go heaven? The Buddha built many monasteries. Did the Buddha go to heaven? No, in Nibbana. Ajahn Chah built many monasteries. But actually, on that in the building, this is one comment Ajahn Chah told me personally. I was there when he said this. And it was just before I came to Australia, and just before Ajahn Chah had a stroke and couldn't speak anymore. And it's one thing which I always remember. And he said to me, he said, in my life, I've built many monasteries, but I haven't built many monks. And that was a very powerful saying, because you know, he had many branch monasteries by then. He hadn't built many monks. And what he's really telling me and telling all of you, it's easy to build monasteries and temples and Buddhist fellowship centers, but it's building people is more important. Building monks, you know, building you know, good male and female lay disciples, building good nuns, that's more important than the buildings themselves. So remember, whether it's a Buddhist fellowship, whether it's Jhana Grove or Bodhinyana Monastery or Dharmasara Monastery, the most important thing are the people. And always forget to remember that. Build people rather than temples. Because, you know, you've seen, you know, in Singapore, in Thailand, many places, there's very elaborate temples. Beautiful with gold and marble and chandeliers. But that doesn't make a beautiful monastery or a beautiful temple. So people inside make it beautiful. So I've mentioned this for the Buddhist Fellowship. You know, this is on tape now, you can tell this. So it's more important that everybody is in harmony and being kind to one another than, you know, you're making the profit or you're keeping the premises clean. I'd rather have a dirty old temple where the paint is flaking off and there's leaves all over the place and it's shabby. I'd rather have that and the people being happy and friendly towards one another than a modesty which is immaculate, where people are cool to one another. People are more important than things. Ajahn Chah, he was criticizing himself. He built many monasteries, but he didn't build enough monks. That's really, really important. So try and build people. Dear Ajahn, we all signed up for a Noble Silence retreat and we expect it to be so. Instead, the chattering is getting bolder and louder each passing day. What is this? Am I disturbing the noise? Is the noise allowed or permitted? What happened to Noble Silence? Please advise. There was this story about the four monks keeping noble silence. It's an old one, but it's relevant. One of them sneezed. And the first monk said, bless you. Second one, you just broken your noble silence. And the third one, ha ha, so have you. And the fourth one said, I'm glad I'm the only one who can keep quiet. So the point is, as soon as you complain, you've broken noble silence. It's the complaining which is the noise. So someone speaks. Let it go. It's finished. It's their karma, not yours. Don't you break your noble silence. Let it go. So as soon as they finish talking, there's no residue left in your mind. Your mind doesn't bounce. They say something, it's gone. Because the biggest noise is not people speaking. It's not people banging the doors. The biggest noise is what only you can hear, what's going on between your ears. That's the noise which stops you getting enlightened and stops you getting peaceful. The inner chatter, the complainer, fault-finding mind. So yes, please keep noble silence between your ears. That's the most important. Are enlightened beings on the higher realm what Western spirituality is called spirit guides or guardian angels? What are Buddhist ideas on spirit guides and angels, not the Christianity type? There was this man, and his spirit guide came to help him. He heard because he was in financial difficulty. You know the global financial crisis? And the spirit guide whispered to his ears, "Go to the casino." He said, "I'm just imagining this." And he heard it again. "Go to the casino. I'm your spirit guide. Come to help you." So he went to the casino. And then he heard the spirit guide again. "Go to the roulette table." So he went to the roulette table. And the spirit guide said, "Put $10 on number 16. So he put $10 on number 16. And the ball went around. And it popped right into number 16. The spirit guide said, "Put it all on number 22. So he put it all on number 22. The ball went around. And it went in number 22. And then the spirit guide said, "Put it all on number 17. So he put all this on number 17. And the ball went around. And it went in number 36. And he heard the spirit guide say, "Shit." See, even spirit guides make mistakes. They're not enlightened. Which is why don't trust the spirit guides. They'll say, "Back this horse," or "Do this," and then you'll hear this shit word afterwards when they make a mistake. So they're not enlightened. Why doesn't the second noble truth include craving for the sixth sense, only craving for five senses? That's a brilliant question. Is craving for being, craving for the sixth sense, why isn't it included? The reason why it's not included, you know, some people saw that and they thought it was some mistake. But it's not a mistake. There's something really important there, because the craving for the pleasure of the sixth sense is the inclination to get the jhanas. Because the Buddha said, this is in the Arana Vibhanga Sutta, where he makes it very clear. He said, "Monks, nuns, meditators, you should distinguish between the two types of pleasure. There's the pleasures of the five senses, which you should avoid. But the pleasure of the sixth sense," he said, "you should follow, develop, make much of, and not be afraid of." Because this is on the tape to impress people. I know what I'm talking about. I'll now say that in Pali. Nabhayita bang, ase witta bang, bahulikata bang, bhaveta bang. It is not to be feared. It is to be followed, made much of, developed. So when you see that, you see this very, very subtle here in Buddhism. You'll find that your minds, your body will always seek for happiness somewhere. If it doesn't find it in the realm of the mind, it will seek it somewhere else. And then pleasures in movies, sex, whatever, travel. But if you can find that pleasure in the mind, then you won't need to seek the pleasures of the senses. It's one of the reasons why, as a monastic, as a monk or a nun, once you get those jhanas, then you are safe as a monk or a nun. You have a pleasure, so you don't want sex anymore. You're not interested anymore, because you've got a nicer pleasure. You can't just say, "I'm not going to have any pleasure anymore." The mind needs that, like the body needs food. But we get that pleasure in a different way, you know, from the pleasures of the mind. Even, may not even be jhanas, but inspiration. Of the joy of doing dana. And it's beautiful sometimes when you give food, you know, to a monk or to a poor person. Or you see others doing that. Sometimes it almost makes you cry. For those of you who haven't done that yet, come over to Bodhinyana at lunchtime, maybe at 10:30. Well, we see it on the Katina Day. All these people coming to put food in the monk's bowls. You know, many of them, they get up maybe sort of 6 o'clock in the morning and they cook the really delicious food. Sometimes the husband complains. They never make food like that for me. But for the monks or the nuns, yeah, they do. And they drive all this way, you know, usually at least an hour, to feed the monks. And then they even wash up for us and give us a donation for the privilege of feeding us. It's incredible. But you see the joy in their hearts when they do that. And that's really inspiring. That joy of inspiration, of dana, of generosity, or of compassion and kindness, when you see someone do an act of kindness, which really just moves you, and think, wow, there's so much beauty in this world. That's called inspiration. That crave for, develop, don't be afraid of it, develop inspiration. If you can do that, your mind will be very bright, happy, and meditation is easy. Sometimes people say, oh no, you get attached. The Buddha said, get attached to that. That's important. Get attached to the inspirations, the joys, the happiness of the mind, the happinesses of the nimittas and jhanas. Get attached to that. Because in the Pasadika Sutta, this is in the Digha Nikaya, this is a part of the Buddha's teachings, he said if anyone criticizes you and say you're going to get attached to that pleasure of the mind, you should tell them, yes, we will get attached to that pleasure of the mind, and the consequence, tell them the consequence of indulging in the pleasures of the mind are four. There's only four possible consequences if you indulge in the pleasures of the mind. Stream winning, once returning, non-returning, or full enlightenment. That's what happens, said the Buddha, if you indulge in the pleasures of the mind. You become enlightened. That's why we should not fear those pleasures. So if you get inspired, indulge in it. Well done. If you feel like crying for joy, please cry. Don't hold it back. If you have pleasure in the meditation, sitting here, it feels so nice, don't think that something is wrong. Go for it. This is a path of Buddhism. Somehow or other, people think that in religion you're supposed to suffer and be miserable. That's called the Puritan Christianity. Well, unfortunately, it's infected many people. Someone once defined the Puritan idea. Puritanism is the fear that somewhere someone is happy. No pain, no gain. That's the motto. That is totally wrong. And this was a great relief, you know, when I became a Buddhist, to go and see monks who were the happiest people I'd ever seen. At first it was weird. I thought this was about suffering. You should know suffering. The monk should be suffering. You don't understand the First Noble Truth. How can you understand anything else? But you saw these were such peaceful and happy beings. And that's what inspired me, because I wanted to be like that. And then you realize there's more to than the First Noble Truth. There's the Third Noble Truth, the end of suffering. And these were the beings who've reached the end of suffering. They were happy. They were blissed out. Just wonderful beings to be with. So that's why, crave that happiness. The happiness born of letting go, of inspiration, of seeing the beauty, not physical beauty, the beauty of a human being who can let go, can be kind and serve others. That's inspiring. Please go for that. Okay, the pleasures which come from scientific discovery or theories, that's the pleasures which will get you to those realms which delight in the creations of others. The Paranimitta Vasavati realm or the, sorry, Nimanavati realm. It is, but you can go much higher than that. That's not bad, but it keeps you in a lower realm.
But also it's a distraction.
It is a distraction. It's not an inspiration born of letting go. It's an inspiration of achieving something, of getting something.
So the mind delight also has to be the
wholesome. Well, the best way of looking at it, the best way of understanding the happiness and delights which are safe, which should be followed, is because they're born, they're created by letting go of something. That's why dana, generosity, you're letting go of something. There's nothing in it for me. For those of you who want to give a donation, say to the nuns' monastery, which we're building, really big donations, so you can put your name on the hall. This is Clementi's Hall, because you've given all of your money for that sum. That is not generosity. That is by advertising rights for your ego. So that's why there's been many generous people here. Have you seen any names of the donors anywhere in this building? There aren't. And some of them are you sitting here. Because we don't buy advertising rights. We give. Quietly, anonymously. And that's really inspiring. Okay, one of the examples. One of the things which really makes me emotional, and I think it's one of the beautiful acts of kindness, are nuns' monastery at Dharmasara. Okay, I initiated that. I thought, yes, it's about time, you know, a monk's monastery was developed, that we should start a monastery for women. And so, with Bianca and Ron, we went looking for places. We started a small fund, not much in it. And we started looking for places. Oh, no, before then. We started a small fund, not much in it. And we weren't really ready to look for any property yet. We didn't have enough money. And then one day, this fellow came from Fremantle. And he came with another Buddhist guy. And this guy told me, I'd never seen him before. Now, he came in jeans and a singlet. He didn't sort of look very wealthy. But he said, last week my wife gave birth to a daughter. It's my first child. And I'm so pleased. I wanted to do something good. You know, in gratitude of getting my first child. I hear you're building a nuns' monastery. Now I don't know if my daughter, who's only just a couple of weeks old, a week old, I don't know if she'd ever want to become a nun, but who knows? I want her to have the opportunity, if she so wishes. So I'd like to give you a donation for your nuns' monastery. And he wrote out a check for 250,000. And I was shaking as I received that. I've never seen such a big check. And then he left. I don't even know his name. He's got no record, maybe in the account somewhere. And that was beautiful. That just kick-started our nuns' monastery. A Westerner, Caucasian, who just wanted to do something in case his daughter wanted to become a Buddhist nun. Now that is what's inspiring. When I think of things like that, I think, wow, there's such beauty, generosity, wonderful things in the world. That inspires me. That's the joy of letting go. And that's the sort of things, wow, that's brilliant. And I indulge in that. I indulge in that to the max. I just keep thinking about that and wow. And it makes me try and do better. Okay. Whew. As we are blessed with the full moon on this retreat, can we please do a gong? Do a gong to celebrate? Thank you, Mr. Moon. What's a gong? Again? Thing? Okay, if you want to... We want to celebrate the full moon, which is tomorrow. Full moons are the best time to become enlightened. The energy is strong. So if you want to celebrate the full moon, tomorrow, get enlightened. That's much better than doing a gong. Drink on. Anyway, that's what I would do anyway. Dear Ajahn, recently there was a tragic event in my family with a relative committing suicide. Recently there was a tragic event in my family with a relative committing a violent crime, resulting in the death of a family friend. The relative will be in prison for many years and our families are struggling to cope. Two questions from this are, it is hard for me to understand karma. Was this friend really meant to die in such a horrible way due to actions in this or past life? I heard a story once about a woman killed by a cow when she came to see the Buddha. When questioned about this, the Buddha said her death would have occurred whether she'd come to visit him or not. Okay, that's question one. I'll do that one first of all. And of course, number one, it's not all due to karma. Because you can die in many, many ways, and sometimes there are accidents happened. This is another story of this guy. And this, he was an Australian man, and he had a really hard time finding a partner. You know, he'd go out to singles club, to other clubs, just trying to find someone to share his life with, and you know, could never find a nice girl. And he went to a counsellor, and the counsellor said, look, take a look in the mirror. Now, you're a mess. So the counsellor said, look, go and do some, you know, real psychological training. Get a positive attitude. Don't be so afraid. And get your teeth fixed. Get a good haircut. And if you go out, get some nice clothes to impress somebody. And so this guy spent a fortune getting his teeth straightened. Getting a personality coach, you know, so he can be positive and charming, you know, and funny, you know, so he could be attractive. And he got this really expensive suit, you know, cost a fortune, and also a nice haircut. And he went out to the club for the first night. And as he was walking across the road to the club, he got hit by a truck and killed. And as soon as he went to heaven, he was really upset. When he saw God, he said, why did you do this? I spent so much time and money and you never even gave me one night. And the God said, I'm terribly sorry, we didn't recognize you. It's a mistake. So accidents do happen. It's not all karma. But what is karma is that once you are born, you can die anyway. So that's the most nice part about karma. Is, you know, you may die because you get murdered, or you get sort of in a traffic accident, or you can die in a tsunami. Because you're born as a human being, that's in the contract. Not everyone will die through murder, but some people will. It's just part of being a human being. But don't worry so much, because this is what I was saying this afternoon in a human rights talk, is that it's very good for especially Buddhists. You can stand up for what's right, and even if you have to take a bullet for your beliefs and get killed for it, it doesn't matter, because you can have another go later on. You get reborn again. But if you're a Christian, you've only got one life. It's a bit rough if you get a bullet for standing up for things you believe in. You only have one go at it, but as Buddhists we get many goes, so it's much easier. So in other words, it's not always karma. I have trouble developing metta, loving kindness, towards my relative responsible for this death. Metta meditation will probably help, but I'm resistant to even doing the meditation. It seems too hard. I get overcome with thoughts and feelings of anger, guilt, shame and sorrow. Is there anything you can recommend? Yes. The only way to move forward is to first take the step of seeing something in that person other than the murder of your relation. If you define that person, he's just a murderer of your relation, there's no way you can ever forgive him or have kindness towards him. You deliberately have to think of all the other things that person has done and the good things they've done. Basically, you have to convince yourself they're worthy of forgiveness. They're worth your metta. If you only think of the terrible stuff they've done and the pain they've caused you and your family, you will never ever be able to forgive them. But you know there's many other things that person has done other than murder your relation. But there are many other things as well. There are many other bricks in the wall, as well as the two bad ones. You have to see those other bricks, the good ones. And then you realize, yeah, they've done a terrible thing, but they're worth forgiving. There's things inside them worth saving. Then metta becomes possible. If all you see is their bad side, their craving, their sort of their killing, you'll never be able to move forward. If ever I just saw those two bad bricks in the wall, I'd always want to destroy it. When I saw the good bricks, the wall was worth saving. That's our forgiveness. That's the first step in forgiveness. It may be someone who's cheated you in business. It may be someone who's stolen your boyfriend. It may be someone who's, crippled you. But if you can see something worthy of forgiveness in them, then metta can start. People chatting a lot today. Silence, please. I think I've already mentioned that. Are you talking too much? Remember that wonderful saying. If you cannot improve upon the silence, then shut up, be quiet. So every time you open your mouth, are you improving on the silence? If people really want to, we can actually get serious with noble silence. We do have some duct tape. If you find anyone's talking too much, please come and send them to me. And I'll get the duct tape. I'll just leave a little hole with the straw so they can have water and other drinks. Now remember, look, it's up to each one of you to be quiet. And it's important because when you restrain the mouth, you don't talk so much, you find you won't think so much either. And your meditation will get much peaceful. And look, you've got lots, you talk all the time in Singapore, wherever you come from. Isn't it nice to try silence? So try silence. But it's up to you, no one can force you. And if anyone talks to you, you don't need to say be quiet, because then you've talked as well. If someone talks to you, just hand over this. That's what you need to do. And then they'll leave you alone. And please, if someone wants to be quiet, please respect that. Don't take their finger and push it away. If by instinct one felt the presence of other beings, what can one do out of loving kindness and compassion? What about during natural disaster? Are there many deaths? Do you think chanting have any effect on the deceased? If so, what should we chant? Yeah, of course. If you have the presence of other beings, loving kindness and compassion always works, and they're kind to you. And also sharing of merits, if they're dead beings, because maybe they need extra merits to get a good rebirth. So there are two things you do. Sharing of merits and being compassionate. But of course, to share merits, you have to make some merits, first of all. So make some merits, and then share them with the deceased beings. That's a wonderful thing you do. But natural disasters, yeah, there's a few ghosts around for a while, but they go pretty quickly. So you don't have to go chanting too much. Otherwise, it would drive the unseen beings crazy. Oh, here it goes again, all this chanting. That's actually one of the reasons why the monks at Bodhinyana Monastery are really good at ghost busting. Because when we chant, we're such bad chanters, the ghosts run away, they can't stand it. So you can. Dear Ajahn Brahm, is it true that you can read our minds? I knew you were going to ask that question. No. Look, what would I want to read your mind for? It's a trash novel, isn't it? Is your mind ready to be read? Of course it ain't. If we practice meditation hard enough, can we read people's minds one day? If you want to be a masochist, you can. But no, they're not worth reading. Dear Ajahn, you said, write the bad part in the toilet paper and flush it away. How about good ones? Can we keep? Yes, but don't put it on toilet paper. Put it on nice parchment and keep that. Thank you. Anyway, the toilet paper has so beautiful. Have so beautiful. I love it. Okay, anyway, whatever. Love toilet paper. Okay, well, there's all sorts of people. If Buddhism and... if Buddhism acknowledged science and science should acknowledge Buddhism, would you consent to scientists sticking wires to a meditating monk and they come out with a drug on how to get into a blissful state with discovery of a pill? Proceeds can be donated to a monastery. Wow. Look, you put wires in a monk's brain. I mean, it's... Look, somebody will ask me, can you do that to me? But oh, look, I'm travelling around. You want me to take all these machines on Singapore Airlines when I go to the BF? And imagine me giving a talk and all the wires coming out. There's so many other things you have to do. You have to go to the shower and the wires will probably come out and pull them back in again. No, it's just a waste of time. And anyway, what does it prove? Scientists, they'll always do more tests and more tests. And even if you do magic things, they won't believe it. They think there's something wrong with the instruments. That's the trouble with scientists. I used to be one myself. Even in those days, in Cambridge University, on the wall of the Cavendish, was it not the Rutherford Laboratory? I've forgot the name of the laboratory. It was the Cavendish, that's right. The Cavendish Laboratory in Cambridge. They used to have graffiti in those days, but the graffiti in those days, it was actually really meaningful. It was actually wise, and the graffiti which was on the outside of the wall of the physics laboratory in Cambridge was the eminence of a great scientist is measured by the length of time they obstruct progress in their field. That is really very profound. The more there are eminent scientists, they stop new discoveries because they overturn their ideas. You know, even scientists have big egos. That's one of the troubles. When I meditate, the mind feels quieter now. I also have the sensation of mini yawns happening in my mind head. I have the feeling that the head gets after a yawn, but I'm not feeling sleepy. Could you explain why? Oh, maybe yawns are just taking a little bit more oxygen. And I think mini yawns, it feels pleasurable. It's maybe a time for a little bit of pity coming up. So, let's see what happens next. Just carry on. Who knows? How do you create a positive relationship space with reincarnation? As it's so tough to achieve nirvana, this or next life for lay people, especially having to achieve nimitta. Thank you, your emptiness. That's my official title, by the way. Your emptiness. How do you create a positive relationship space with reincarnation? Don't know, we don't really understand that. But anyway, reincarnation is there. Whether you like it or not, you're stuck with it. So if you are going to reincarnate, you might as well reincarnate in a good space. So be kind. Be good. It's just like those of you who've got a car. When you have a car, do you buy insurance for your car in case it has an accident or gets stolen? Now, what a Buddhist does, they don't just get the minimum insurance, they get really good insurance. Which means if their car gets in an accident, then they can get enough payout that the next model will be like a Rolls Royce or a Ferrari. And this is a simile. You don't just do the minimum in life, you do even extra good karma. Better generosity, better compassion, better meditation. So when this old body dies, in your next life you can get a Ferrari of a body. In other words, get into some high heaven realm. So that's what karma is, it's your insurance. And when you die you get the payout. But if you haven't paid up your insurance, when you die in your next life you get what they call an old bomb of a vehicle. Maybe a skateboard if you're lucky. Not a car. So you get a low life. So please, be a good person. And then you have a good life. Hey, someone's got... That's pretty amazing. Someone's done a cartoon. It's a really good cartoon too. Springboard to blissful states. What is it and how to get there? Springboard to blissful states is letting go. That's the springboard. Let go. And then you can fly high. Your past and future are like a bird with two heavy weights on their wings. Past and future, it can't even get off the ground. So it lets the past and future go. Then it can fly high. And it gets so high, and it can't fly higher. Because on its back, it's got all its thinking. So it throws that off as well. And then the bird flies high and high. Birds don't carry anything. You know birds migrate. There are some birds in Perth who migrate to Singapore. They don't have any check-in baggage. I've seen some of you coming here for this retreat. All these bags you've got. My goodness, what do you need? Be like a bird with no baggage, no backpack, who flies from land to land, from moment to moment, carrying no baggage from the past, no worries about the future, no thoughts. Fly! Then you go really high. That's what you should do. That's how you're the springboard. I love the Q&A sessions. I think it beats invention by Steve Jobs, because it will always look forward to it during the day. That's bad news, because Steve Jobs just died. So does that mean I'm going to go soon? Tell me, can one get wisdom without inner thoughts and having an analytical mind? It's the inner thoughts which stop wisdom. One of my sayings, never allow your knowledge to stop you seeing the truth. You understand what I mean then? You have all your knowledge, all of your learning, and that stops you seeing the truth. You see what you're told to see, what you expect to see, not what's really there. So never let your knowledge stand in the way of truth. Your mind is peaceful and still. You can see what peace and stillness is, what happiness is. You will follow what other people say. You never see the truth. Shh. Be quiet. And the truth is right in front of you. Some people say that meditation is Buddhism. Does that mean if I know how to meditate, then I know all about Buddhism? Many thanks. If you know all about meditation, then you know all about Buddhism. If you only know something about meditation, you only know something about Buddhism. That's pretty profound, isn't it? Wow, I'm really proud of that. No, I'm one of the most humblest of monks in the whole world, and I'm very proud of being the most humble. In fact, I'm going to apply to the Guinness Book of Records of being the most humble monk in the world. That's what I say, if you're humble, flaunt it. I'm messing around. Do you know, Bob, the toilet ceremony really works. Hey! Down here, are the toilets still working or they bunged up? Because people have done such bad things, I think there's no toilet paper left. And all the toilets are all blocked. The toilet ceremony really works. I tried it last night and it's worked wonders. I feel so much lighter now. By the way, where do you keep the plunger? My toilet bowl is gone now. I thought so. Very good. But it still works. It's nice to let things go. My friend, he said when he plays Sudoku long enough, the numbers disappear. Is this also meditation? How similar or different? Will he get enlightened this way too? Well, that's really weird questions, but never mind. It's probably he's going blind, the numbers disappear. That's what happens if you do these things for too long. That's what sort of my mother used to say. People say that's what the Buddha said, if you watch the fire too long, sit by my fire, you go blind. I don't know what the thing about blindness is, but always when you do bad things, you're supposed to go blind, but that's what's probably happened here. The numbers disappear, so it's also meditation. I think maybe if you do it anything long enough, the mind just turns off. Basically, you can't see it anymore, because there's nothing really going on to excite or interest the mind, because when things don't move and the mind's not interested anymore, it just turns off. Just like sometimes, I mentioned that the other day, when your wife keeps nagging you, after a while, you know, you can't hear her anymore, because it doesn't interest the mind anymore. It's natural. It's your husband's not being a bad husband and being insensitive. It's that you're speaking too much. That happens. It's just a way of things. So remember, people who speak little, then their words are like treasures. The only reason why diamonds are expensive is because there's not that many of them. They're rare. And why rocks are not so expensive, because there's too many of them. So let your words be like diamonds or gold. So rare that they're precious and valued. Don't let them be like dirt all over the place. Anyone can pick them up. So therefore, when you speak, people will listen. If you speak too much, they will turn off. Do you have any psychic powers? If so, what are they? Okay. People have asked me that so many times. Now I'm going to actually tell you. I'm going to tell the truth. Yes, I do have psychic power. Well, the Buddha said, of all the psychic powers, there's only one which he praises. You know which one that is? Teaching the Dhamma. And I'm pretty good at that. I think I can fairly claim that. Many people listen to me all over the world. So I think I can sort of say that, can't I? And that's, Buddha said, that's the only one which really matters. But it's not the one you're interested in, is it? So that's why you don't mind claiming. Dear Ajahn, I entered a stage of meditation where my breath got more and more shallow and lighter, and then it slowly disappeared. Without my breath to focus on, I began to be aware of my heartbeats. Pom, 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 pom. This is the right way to meditate. Is there something wrong with my heart? Should I see a cardiologist? That's really nice. Thank you so much for writing funny questions. But the serious part of that is, yeah, when your breath starts to fade away, sometimes people do watch their heartbeat, but that is a big distraction. So if that happens, you go straight back to the breath. Make the breath sort of start to work again. And see if the next time the breath disappears, you don't go to the heart, you know, to the physical heartbeat. You let the breath disappear and you stay with the feeling of peace. And sometimes people think, well, what am I supposed to watch? Peace. But what's peace? This is where you have to, what I was mentioning this morning or yesterday, you have to recognize what this peace is. What happens when the breath disappears? What's left? After a while you recognize that. And then you become familiar with it. Then you can stay with it. You are learning what peace and stillness mean. You're recognizing this incredible peace and stillness in the mind. And look, this is my own experience. Sometimes you've been so peaceful, you think that this is the ultimate peace. There can never be anything more peaceful than this. Then you go to a deeper stage of meditation, it's more peaceful. It's incredible. And I thought that that was the most peaceful you could ever be. Then you recognize something even more subtle or more peaceful. That's amazing, just you really get insight into the meaning of peace. Not through thinking about it, by experiencing deeper and deeper stages. It's wonderful and fascinating, and you have a, now, the joy of it is enough, but understanding what peace truly is, you know, more than most other people in the world, it's an incredible experience. Ajahn, can walking fast or doing chores fast spoil one's meditation during the later part of the day? If you do the chores fast, that will certainly spoil the meal and probably break a few plates, waste water. So walking fast, if it's the time to walk fast, but don't force it. You know, sometimes, you know, if I've, you know, got a bit of tummy upset, I like walking fast because that gets the digestion going. So there's times when I really like to walk fast. And I say that indigestion is, you know, what I called, I said yesterday, that's one of the occupational hazards for a monk because we don't know what we're fed. So if I get some indigestion, I try and walk fast and just gets all the sort of whatever's there out of me. But other times, you know, you're walking, you just quite naturally, you slow down. You know, I don't press the accelerator or put the brake on when I'm doing walking meditation. It's totally natural. The body does the walking. If it wants to walk fast, it does it itself. If it's slow, it does it itself. And doing chores as well. You know, if it's the right thing to do it fast, so you can finish and get, you know, to the next talk or subject, fine. But if doing it slowly is the right thing to do, then do it slowly. So just keep it natural, with no major rules. If you keep it natural, the latter part of the day will also be natural and peaceful. Ajahn Brahm, good evening. Good evening to you. By the way, would like to verify, please. Actually, the nimitta is always present, right? It is just when our other five senses are very busy, it cannot be perceived. Hence, after perceiving it the first time, it's actually quite easy to perceive it again, right? Since we know what to look for. Lastly, does it help to meditate near holy persons or objects? Thank you very much. In a sense, the nimitta is always there because the mind is always there, but again, it's so weak, it's dominated by the other five senses. So again, you don't see it. But when it's energized, inspiration, joy, lots of meditation, being a good person that really energizes the jitta. I don't mean like having to think a lot, I mean just the purity, the inspiration energizes it. Then it's very easy to manifest. And it's true that sometimes it comes up, you first close your eyes and it's right there. Simply because your mind has become very strong. Or even if you really do a lot of meditation, get into the jhanas, sometimes you open your eyes, you're talking to someone afterwards and the big light in front of you. You know, you have to look at people through that light. So the nimitta, it's just the mind is so strong. It's like dominating the other five senses, even when you've got your eyes open. But that's only when you do lots of meditation. So yes, in that sense it's always present. Does it help to meditate near holy persons or objects? Yes, sometimes it does. So sometimes you get, again, inspiration. And sometimes, you know, I've noticed this in Bodhinyana Monastery, when somebody gets a deep meditation that night, most other people get a good meditation. There's some sort of synchronicity or some sort of resonance, you know, whatever it is. So when someone gets a nice meditation, a lot of other monks do as well. No, when to see the nimitta, does the five senses and the hindrances have to disappear? No. Simply because the mind has got a certain strength, the five senses have got a certain strength. For most people, the five senses are so much stronger than the five senses, you can't even see the nimitta. But when the five senses get settled down, calmed down, you're not so interested in seeing, in talking, in hearing and feeling and stuff. When that settles down, they become softer, the mind becomes louder, until it becomes of an amplitude that it's louder than the senses. So sometimes you can still hear the sounds, but the nimitta is so strong it dominates. It's like, you know, six people talking. It's the one who talks the loudest, it's the one who gets heard. So the six people, the six senses. And if the nimitta of the mind is the loudest, then it dominates. Five hindrances are almost gone. The one which is left is often restlessness, which is why the nimitta keeps moving. Dear Mr. Monk, it's me. Slow about telling the one about the world's best goalkeeper. Oh, that's, I know this is from Eric. If you don't tell him, your karma will be really crap. PPS, after spelling mistakes, I write a different mistake of the week. Okay, it's Eric wants me to tell you about the goalkeeper, because it's his favourite story. And it's not just a joke, it's a story about conditioning and how people have habit. It's very difficult because, like, for example, if you've always been watching the breath at the tip of the nose, it's so hard for me to teach you not to do that. And if you're always like thinking, it's so hard to condition you not to think. People are creatures of habit. And this was a story in one of the, the favelas in Rio de Janeiro. There's the poor quarters, the slums. In one of these old buildings, there was a fire. And because it was a poor area, now the fire brigade didn't come until it was far too late. And so there was a whole crowd watching this burning building, and on the fourth or fifth story, they saw at the window of this burning building a woman with her baby. Do something to save her. And the kid, what could you do? And then, as the crowd, we're just wondering when the fire brigade is going to come and what they could do. This about 23, 24-year-old muscly man came through the crowd. And he said, I am the goalkeeper of the Brazilian football team. Ever since I played international football, I've never let in one penalty. I'm a great goalkeeper. I can save anything. And the people in the crowd, because they follow soccer, they thought, actually, it's him. It's him. And he looked up at the woman and said, throw down your baby. I will catch it. And she said, I can't. You'll miss it. He said, I'm the Brazilian national goalkeeper. I can save anything. Throw down your baby. And at that, the flames got so strong, she just had no choice. She had to trust him. She threw down her little baby. She was going to end her life, but at least she'll save her child. But she rushed so much that she hit her elbow in the window. Instead of dropping the baby went all over the place. And the goalkeeper crouched down. Have you ever watched football, soccer? He crouched down. And he watched the baby fall, tumbling around. The last moment, he dived to his right. And he caught the baby. And he rolled 3 times. Like they do in the soccer matches. And the crowd went wild. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And the goalkeeper, he punched the air, you know, with one hand. And he dropped the baby on his right foot with the other and kicked it through a plate glass window. It's only a joke. Because that's conditioning. That's what goalkeepers do. They catch the ball, drop it into their foot and kick it up to the ground. That's why it's so hard to change habits. What is the difference between reincarnation and being reborn? Thanks, Ajahn Brahm. Nothing, only the spelling. There are many instances of the dying seeing their loved one coming to fetch them. Is this an illusion? Yes and no. Because what you're seeing is sometimes an imitus when you're dying. Remember, the mind is strong, the 5 senses when you're dying are just really being subdued, they're weaker and weaker and weaker until, you know, they stop, and that's when you die. So the mind is stronger. And a lot of time you're seeing what you want to see. You're seeing what you expect to see. So, you know, you're seeing so this beautiful nimitta, and you say that's your loved one coming to fetch you. It's not always your loved one, it's just nimitta. You're seeing something real. Lastly, do you think Jesus was an enlightened being? Enlightened beings don't get executed. That's why whenever it gets to Easter, I always call it execution day. Because that's what it was. It was an execution of a person. And obviously, that wasn't sort of what usually happens to an enlightened being. So, who knows? What is an enlightened being? An enlightened being would never say, I am the only way. That's number one. Enlightened being says, like the Buddha said, this is a great saying because at the time when the Buddha was about to pass away, he was not a monk, he later became a monk, Subhadra. He asked him all these questions. And one question he asked was a common one which many Buddhists ask. Is it possible to become enlightened in other religions? And can a Christian or a Muslim become enlightened? And with the great wisdom of a Buddha, he gave this very beautiful answer. He said, look, in any religion, path, spirituality, practice, where you find the Eightfold Path, there you will find enlightened beings. It's not what you call yourself. It's not sort of, you know, what you identify with. It's what you do, how you practice. Cause and effect. And if you practice that Eightfold Path, then you become enlightened. Whether you call yourself a Christian, a Buddhist, a Muslim, a Bodhisattva or whatever, if you follow that path, that's where it leads. It's a beautiful answer because it doesn't criticize others. It just says, well, if you want to become enlightened, have some right view, non-self, not sort of the power of a god or anything, non-self, karma, you know, have right thoughts, making peace, be kind, be gentle, keep your precepts, have right livelihood, be mindful, let go, be still in meditation, then you'll find enlightenment. And anyway, Jesus was supposed to be a Buddhist monk. Didn't you know that? That's another story for another time. Maybe I'll tell that tomorrow. So you can ask that in the question. Was Jesus a Buddhist monk? And tomorrow you will find out. It will give you something to look forward to. Usually when I used to go to these cinemas when I was a kid, they had these episodes of Batman or Superman. And they always had the episode ending. You didn't know what was going to happen next, so you had to come next week. So the answer will be told to you tomorrow night. Same time, same place. See you then. Okay, three big sadhus. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Very good. Okay, have a nice night. See you in the morning.